In his wonderful book, Land of Lincoln, Adventures in Abe's America, Andrew Ferguson recounts his meeting with an immigrant family from Thailand living in Chicago, running a Thai restaurant just a few blocks from the Orthodox Jewish neighborhood where I grew up. The family's patriarch, a man by the name of Oscar Eshe, developed with his wife a passionate devotion to Abraham Lincoln. In an interview, Oscar, translating for his wife, explained to Ferguson how this obsession with the 16th president began. He said, quote, "My wife sees the license plate on all the cars after we move here to Chicago. Land of Lincoln, they say. She wonders, who is this Lincoln? So she gets a book from a friend to read about Lincoln. She says, in our country, it is our custom that we pay respect to the person who is in charge of the country. And here it is Lincoln's country. He's the head man in history. You see him everywhere. Everyone loves him. My wife reads the book, and we realize we must go pay respects to this man. He is a very great man. He helps the poor. He tells everyone that they are equal, that no man is better than any other man. This is very important." And then Oscar Eshe points out to Andrew Ferguson a small statue of Lincoln that was sitting on the bar in his Thai food restaurant, an ivory reproduction of David Chester French's Lincoln Memorial. Eshe explains the importance of this religious icon. He says, "We bought a statue to show our respect, and we put this here. And ever since that time we have statue, our business never go down. Always the business goes up, never down, no matter what." And then he says, "Lincoln does this." Eshe then explains that as a token of gratitude and reverence to the role that the Lincoln statue has played in their success, every evening he sets out a dinner before the figurine, an offering or a korban or a sacrifice to Lincoln. And as she explains to Ferguson, it's a full meal, everything, entree, dessert, appetizer, drink also. We change the meal every day, so it's always different. We serve him everything. And at this point, Mrs. Eshe interrupts, correcting her husband in Thai. And Mr. Eshe says, "Yes, everything, but no pork. We don't want to be disrespectful." So Ferguson is very puzzled. What do you mean? And Eshe then made his intentions clear, and he says to Andrew Ferguson, "He is Abraham Lincoln, yes? Jewish people don't eat pork." Now, Abraham Lincoln may not have been a member of our faith or our people, but there is something profoundly Jewish about him. And here I refer not to his dietary habits, but to his character as a leader. In reflecting, as the Eshe family put it, that no man is better than any other man. While I would not put it exactly that way, one of the biblical virtues is humility, demanded, expected, celebrated, not only in the common man, but also in the greatest of its leaders. Moses, we are told, was anav mikol adam asher al pnei adama, more humble than any other man on the face of the earth. Later, in addressing Israel before his death about the future monarchy Israel would establish, Moses demands that the Jewish king forever carry a Torah scroll with him, levilti yarum levavo meachav, lest his heart grow haughty over his brethren. And Lincoln, alone among the statesmen of the 19th century, was known for his striking humility. One European journalist who had been critical of Lincoln was introduced to the president, and the Secretary of State said humorously to Lincoln as he introduced him, "Here is one of your enemies." Right, and he writes that Lincoln responded, "I did not know that I had any enemies." And, writes the journalist, "I can still feel as I write the grip of that great bony hand held out to me in token of friendship." And he then concludes, "In my life, I have seen a good number of men distinguished by their talents or their station, but I never saw anyone so apparently unconscious that this distinction conferred upon him any superiority as Abraham Lincoln." Lest we think this was the only account of Lincoln's extraordinary humility, we have this remarkable letter sent by Lincoln to Grant, right after Grant's victory at Vicksburg. Lincoln writes as follows. "My dear General, I do not remember that you and I ever met personally. I write this now as a grateful acknowledgement for the almost inestimable service you have done the country. I wish to say," Lincoln continues, "a word further. When you first reached the vicinity of Vicksburg, I thought you should do what you finally did. March the troops across the neck, run the batteries with the transports, and thus go below. And I never had any faith, except the general hope that you knew better than I, that the Yazoo Pass expedition and the like could succeed. When you got below and took Port Gibson, Grand Gulf, and vicinity, I thought you should go down the river and join General Banks. And when you turned northward, east of the Big Black, I feared it was a mistake." And Lincoln concludes as follows. "I now wish to make the personal acknowledgement that you were right and I was wrong. Yours very truly, Abraham Lincoln." End of letter. Reflecting on this letter following Lincoln's death, his friend Joseph Gillespie remarked that it, quote, "required no effort on his part to admit another man's superiority, and his admission that General Grant was right and he was wrong about operations in Vicksburg was not intended for effect, as some suppose, but was perfectly in character." This is indeed Lincoln. Lincoln's humility and Judaism's insistence on humility in its leaders is striking because, by and large, great statesmen are not humble. And their lack of humility can seem at times the very source of their strength. In this respect, one can contrast Lincoln, the greatest statesman of the 19th century, with the man who is indisputably the greatest statesman of the 20th century, Winston Churchill. William Manchester's glorious biography, The Last Lion, describes Churchill in an argument with his butler. "You were very rude to me," Churchill said to his servant. "Well," he responded, "you were very rude to me as well." "Yes," Churchill said, "but I am a great man." I cited this anecdote in a conversation, a public conversation, that I recently had with the extraordinary historian Andrew Roberts, and queried him about it, and about humility in statesmen. And Andrew responded that he could not name a single instance of a great European statesman noted for his humility. But Lincoln, as we shall see, actually reflects the fact that a great statesman can make this virtue manifest. And this suggests that Lincoln's life, his character and career, can teach us a great deal about the Jewish notion of human excellence in politics, and of the role of humility in statesmanship. This lecture will therefore differ from those that have come before in this series. While we've previously studied the Jews in America during the period of the Civil War, or the impact that the Bible had on Lincoln's own decisions and addresses, today we will utilize Lincoln as a lens by which to study the role of humility in leaders and in statesmen for the Bible and in the modern age. We'll begin with analyzing what exactly humility means for Jewish thought, for human beings in general, and for statesmen in particular. We will then reflect on the role humility played in Lincoln's statesmanship, contrasting it with the alternative, the awe-inspiring career of Churchill. We will then conclude by explaining why it is the greatest statesman in American history, alone among Western polities, why in America Lincoln is known and celebrated for his humility, and why in the end the study of the career of this greatest of presidents is important not only for American Jews interested in political thought, but also, and perhaps even more important, for Jews thinking about this subject in the Jewish state today. Let's address then first what humility means and what it cannot mean. In 1998, the Journal of Philosophy held a symposium in which its respondents attempted to define humility. One prominent philosopher, Judith Driver, in an essay entitled "The Virtue of Ignorance," argued that humility is, quote, "underestimating one's worth." In other words, one is admirably modest if one mistakenly believes that one is less important or gifted than one truly is. It is virtuous, in Driver's opinion, to be ignorant of how extraordinary you are. This explanation of humility is a common one, but it is, I think, wrong. Let us take the most famous biblical verse about humility. "And Moses was the most humble man that ever lived." For rabbinic tradition, who wrote this sentence? Moses. And Moses' humility is extolled in the very same passage that follows these verses, in which Moses' sibling is publicly punished for questioning whether Moses truly is extraordinary and great. This story serves for Maimonides as the foundation of our faith. We are the faith of Moses, founded on the proposition that Moses was a greater prophet than any other, which means that Moses was himself religiously obligated to acknowledge his own greatness. The story is told of the 19th century physicist Henry Augustus Rowland, known to be a modest and self-effacing man, who was once called as a witness in a trial. And while he was being cross-examined, the lawyer asked him, "What are your qualifications as an expert witness in this case?" And Rowland quietly replied, "I am the greatest living expert on the subject under discussion." After the testimony, a friend who knew Rowland's disposition expressed his surprise at the professor's uncharacteristic answer. And Rowland replied, "Well, what did you expect me to do? I was under oath. I had to tell the truth." For Moshe to deny that he was, in some sense, the greatest individual to ever live would not be mere perjury, it would be heresy. To put it another way, if Moses did not acknowledge that he was the greatest religious figure in history, then he wouldn't be the greatest religious figure in history. This means that true humility in leaders cannot, should not, mandate a denial of one's greatness and one's gifts. Rather, it involves a pairing of a recognition of and a justified pride in those gifts with an understanding of one's limitations and even of one's nothingness before the awe-inspiring presence of God. In this respect, Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik famously spoke of man's ability to simultaneously embody majesty and humility. And one story, of which I read several years ago, provides an apt example of what Rabbi Soloveitchik means. It was in 2006 that Dr. Yisrael Robert Aumann of Hebrew University was informed that he had just been awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics for his groundbreaking work in game theory, and was expected to present himself in Stockholm's Royal Palace so that he could be awarded this prestigious prize by the King of Sweden himself. And the awarding of this prize to this economist, who is an Orthodox Jew, presented a unique challenge. As one article describes, quote, "Every male present at the award ceremony is required to wear tails and a white bow tie provided by the Nobel Foundation. There is, however, a possible problem." What is that problem? Shatnez. The Bible in Leviticus prohibits the wearing of garments that are shatnez, meaning garments that are wool and linen woven together. Thus the article writes, "Since the Torah forbids wearing shatnez, Professor Aumann realized that he would have to have these garments checked for shatnez. This required having the chief rabbi of Sweden pick up one such outfit and bring it to Israel, where it could be checked with a microscope in one of Jerusalem's many shatnez labs. The examination revealed," the article informs us, "that the tuxedos were indeed shatnez, and so we are further informed the Aumann solved this problem by renting shatnez-free formal wear from an Israeli agency and having it flown to Stockholm for the ceremony." And this makes sense because Israel has long been known as a source of formal attire. And the truth is that this is one of the most striking stories, theologically, philosophically, that I read in a long time. Rabbinic Judaism divides the 613 commandments of the Torah into two sets. There are what the rabbis call mishpatim, laws whose rationale is discernible, and chukim, rules, obligations which we obey without any full understanding as to their ultimate purpose. Shatnez belongs to the latter category. It is, for the rabbis, a paradigmatic chok, one whose very meaning is mysterious. And it was Rabbi Soloveitchik in his landmark essays, Majesty and Humility and The Lonely Man of Faith, where he describes two different personalities, what he termed Adam the First and Adam the Second. Adam the First is majestic. He seeks to fulfill the Almighty's injunction in Eden, Milu et ha'aretz v'chivshua, conquer the world, which he understands as referring to the achievement of scientific breakthroughs, the curing of diseases, the building of cities and countries, serving as God's partner in creation. That's Adam the First. But then there is Adam the Second, man who is ever aware of his finitude, who seeks not to conquer but to return to his roots, who finds fulfillment not in majestic achievement, but in humbling himself before his omnipotent, omniscient creator. Judaism, said Rabbi Soloveitchik, recognizes both Adams as being inherent in our nature, both willed by God, And Rabbi Soloveitchik further notes that the union in the Torah of laws that can be easily understood and those that defy attempts at explanation together represent the majesty and the humility of human nature and the human mind. The existence of mishpatim, those whose laws, whose rationale can be discerned, that signifies the extraordinary intellect with which man has been gifted by God. And yet, writes Rabbi Soloveitchik, quote, precisely because of the supremacy of the intellect in human life, the Torah requires at times the suspension of the authority logos. Man defeats himself by accepting norms that the intellect cannot assimilate into its normative system. The Judaic concept of chok, he writes, represents human surrender. Keep this phrase in mind. A man burdens himself with laws whose rational motif he cannot grasp. So here, ladies and gentlemen, you have Robert Allman, one who has lived the life of the mind, whose institute, as an article points out, at Hebrew University is actually named the Center for Rationality, who has entered academia and achieved fame and fortune entirely through his extraordinary intellect, through pure thought. Now at the pinnacle of this achievement, when he's being honored by the world for his intellectual insights, at that point he observes a commandment whose very essence embodies the notion that there is many a thing that the human mind, no matter how gifted, cannot comprehend, that there are rituals that we are obligated to observe solely because of the commandment of the Almighty. Because, as Hamlet said to Horatio, there are many things in heaven and earth that are not dreamt of in your philosophy. Think of the dichotomy, the dialectic of a man receiving the Nobel Prize, and not a Nobel Prize like the Nobel Peace Prize. They give that to pretty much anybody, okay? Receiving the Nobel Prize for economics from the King of Sweden in his shotness-free tuxedo, attired in the formal wear of the palace that is simultaneously tailored to the dictates of the Torah, thereby embodying at the same time human greatness and limitation. God, what we call in Hebrew, gadlut ha'adam and shiflut ha'adam, rationality and awe-inspired faith, or as per Rabbi Soloveitchik, majesty and humility. Now, Rabbi Soloveitchik's religious anthropology and Alman's interesting example allows us to understand why the approach to human nature and excellence for Judaism differs from that of Greece, why Jerusalem differs here from Athens. Leon Kass was once asked, as one who had first taught Greek thought in university before turning to the Bible, what difference in perspective he found between the two traditions. And he gave us one example, the following. He said, the peak of the Aristotelian ethical virtues is the great-souled man, the man of consummate nobility and goodness, who goes in the city as if he were a god. And, it says several times in Aristotle, Cass pointed out, he wonders at nothing because nothing is great to him. It is, he said, like Gulliver among the Lilliputians. There is a suggestion there that from the Greek point of view, at least from the philosophical point of view, there is nothing to be in awe of. And in fact, Aristotle says in the Ethics, eidos, reverent awe, is not a virtue. It's a useful passion in the young, but a grown man has no reason to feel this emotion. That's a specific attempt, Cass said, to cut off what looks like veneration of something higher than the human. End quote. And I would add that in contrast to the Aristotelian great-souled man, Moses' career begins precisely with a moment of reverent awe. And the angel of the Lord appeared unto him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed. And Moses said, I will turn aside now and see this great sight, why the bush is not burnt. At that moment he is chosen. The Bible differs from Aristotle because the forms of human excellence it presents, and Moses is presented as excellent above all others, teaches us that greatness is to be found not in denying one's greatness, but in pairing it with a humble acknowledgement of the limits of one's knowledge, ability, and wisdom in the presence of an omniscient and omnipotent Almighty God. If this is true about a scientist or an economist, if Robert Allman can both be celebrated for the insights of his mind while reflecting the very limitations of that very same intellect before the divine mind, then Judaism insists this can be true for a statesman as well. For while statesmanship is not a science or even a social science, it is its own form of wisdom, ingenious instinct, or understanding. As Isaiah Berlin put it, wisdom in statesmen is understanding rather than knowledge. What some kind of acquaintance with relevant facts of such a kind that enable those who have it to tell what fits what. In Berlin's words, it is a capacity in the first place for synthesis rather than analysis, for knowledge in the sense in which conductors know their orchestras, as opposed to that which chemists know the contents of their test tubes or mathematicians know the rules that their symbols obey. End quote. Statesmanship is, in other words, a form of instinct, but it is an art rather than a science. Great statesmen conduct history the way maestros conduct their orchestras. And for the Bible, this is an aptitude to be admired. And yet it must be combined with a recognition that there is something, someone much greater than he who is the true conductor. Whereas Aristotle's great-souled man wonders at nothing, the statesman for Jewish thought must simultaneously act within history and yet still wonder at God's hand in history. He must feel himself both subject and object, actor and acted upon. He plays three-dimensional chess and yet remains in his mind simultaneously a pawn in the designs of the Almighty and feels it a privilege to be a pawn held in his heavenly hand. Is such a dialectic possible? Can one combine two seemingly opposite notions? We have such an example. In 1864, Lincoln wrote to Kentucky politician and editor Albert Hodges a public letter explaining his rationale in ordering emancipation for the southern states. Kentucky was still a slave state, but it was part of the Union. And many in Kentucky wondered what it said about Lincoln's approach to government, that he had emancipated all the slaves in the Confederacy. Lincoln begins by explaining, quote, "I am naturally anti-slavery. If slavery is not wrong, nothing is wrong. I cannot remember when I did not so think and feel. And yet, I have never understood that the presidency conferred upon me an unrestricted right to act officially upon this judgment and feeling." That's his first step. Then he goes on to explain why he felt it was necessary, in a moment of national emergency, as a military form of action, to take the extraordinary step as commander-in-chief to order the emancipation of the slaves in the South. He writes, "In 1862, I was, in my best judgment, driven to the alternative of either surrendering the Union and with it the Constitution, or of laying a strong hand upon the colored element. I chose the latter. In choosing it, I hoped for greater gain than loss. But of this, I was not entirely confident. More than a year of trial now shows no loss by it in our foreign relations, none in our popular sentiment, none in our white military force, no loss by it anyhow or anywhere." Lincoln thus is defending the importance of action, of his own leadership, of his decision, unlike any other in American history, to order emancipation. In this he embodies confidence, strength, independence. But then he adds the following, concluding the letter with these words, "In telling this tale, I attempt no compliment to my own sagacity. I claim not to have controlled events, but confess plainly that events have controlled me. Now, at the end of 3 years' struggle, the nation's condition is not what either party nor any man devised or expected. God alone can claim it. Whither it is tending seems plain. If God now wills the removal of a great wrong, and wills also that we of the North, as well as you of the South, shall pay fairly for our complicity in that wrong, impartial history will find therein new cause to attest and revere the justice and goodness of God." The shift is palpable. Lincoln explains why he made one of the most extraordinary and independent decisions in American history, and yet he closes by confessing that he feels himself not only subject, but object in God's hand, vessel in God's plan. Similarly to the Quaker leader Eliza Gurney, Lincoln said, quote, "We are indeed going through a great trial. In the very responsible position in which I happen to be placed, being a humble instrument in the hands of our Heavenly Father, as I am, and as we all are, to work out his great purposes, I have desired that all my works and acts may be according to his will, and that it might be so. I have sought his aid, but if after endeavoring to do my best in the light which he affords me, I find my efforts fail, I must believe that for some purpose unknown to me, he wills it otherwise." Majesty and humility can coexist in a complex way. As the Hillsdale College historian David Bobb has put it, Lincoln's mature political thought was carefully honed and he had a theological richness unrivaled in American history. Abraham Lincoln demonstrated that humility gives us eyes to see that we are not God, Lincoln knew that he was not a purely passive instrument. God's power never divests us of responsibility. Humility is not inaction combined with hope that things will work out. However much Abraham Lincoln spoke of himself as a humble instrument in the hand of God, he never lapsed into inactivity. The majesty and the humility demanded of leaders by the Bible involves a dialectic. They must see themselves simultaneously as directors of history and of objects in God's divinely directed drama whose ultimate goals they cannot fully understand. It is this aspect of Lincoln's life that we do not find when we study the finest hour of another extraordinary statesman, which is Churchill. I say this, I must say, not as criticism of Churchill. I revere Churchill. His example never ceases to inspire. I offer it instead as a form of contrast. In his memoirs, Churchill describes his state of mind when he was finally appointed prime minister by the king. Churchill writes, "I cannot conceal from the reader of this truthful account a profound sense of relief. At last I have the authority to give directions over the whole scene. I felt as if I was walking with destiny and that all my past life has been but a preparation for this hour and for this trial. I thought I knew a good deal about it all and was sure I should not fail. Therefore, although impatient for the morning, I slept soundly and had no need for cheering dreams. Facts are better than dreams." End quote. Now, do we, ladies and gentlemen, begrudge Churchill his self-confidence, his delight in being in control, his seeming belief that his very will could win the war? We don't really. In fact, we are grateful for it. Leon Cass himself, who noted how unbiblical the Aristotelian conception of excellence actually is, nevertheless published an essay wherein he defends its importance and how and why he believes that Churchill is the modern version of Aristotle's great-souled man. "Most of my students," Cass writes, "find the great-souled man hard to take. They resent his disdain for lesser folk. They dislike his cool aloofness. And," writes Cass, "they proudly assert that they wouldn't want to have dinner with him, without considering that the feeling might, of course, be mutual." This critique, Cass continues, shows how spoiled we are. We liberal Democrats, he continues, living in this great commercial republic and enjoying our freedom, peace, and prosperity, tend to take too much for granted. There comes a time of crisis, and who knows when the next will arrive, in which the survival of the community devoted to comfort, health, and safety depends on the virtue of men who are devoted to something beyond comfort, health, and safety. In times of greatest crisis, he writes, even egalitarians come to recognize the need for a great-souled man, a human being who really is superior and who will confidently, because deservingly, take the helm. That is Cass. And he is right. And yet, we do have another example of someone who took the helm in a time of crisis for his country. When many states in the Union responded to this man's election by seceding and forming a confederacy of their own. True, it was not the same as Churchill's crisis. The Nazis were not descending to destroy his home and civilization. But no president has faced a challenge such as this one in American history. And we have his ad hoc emotional reaction at the moment when Lincoln left his hometown to travel to his inauguration. And it is not, as with Churchill, relief at last having the authority to give direction over the whole scene. Having refused initially to deliver formal remarks, upon his departure, suddenly as the train from Springfield prepared to pull away, the man once known for his lack of faith suddenly burst out with the following: "My friends, no one not in my situation can appreciate my feeling of sadness at this parting. To this place and the kindness of this people I owe everything. Here I have lived a quarter of a century and have passed from a young to an old man. I now leave not knowing when or whether ever I may return, with a task before me greater than that which rested upon Washington. Without the assistance of the divine being who ever attended him, I cannot succeed. With that assistance, I cannot fail. Trusting in him who can go with me and remain with you and be everywhere for good, let us confidently hope that all will yet be well. To his care commending you, as I hope in your prayers you will commend me, I bid you an affectionate farewell." There is literal in Churchill's words in his memoir that parallels the sentiment here. Churchill did indeed believe in God, but as Andrew Roberts once put it, in Churchill's theology, God's job seemed mainly to be safeguarding the well-being of Winston Churchill. Churchill himself said famously that when asked if he saw himself as a member of the church, he says he sees himself as a flying buttress on the church. He supports the church, but outside it. And so this is not the Churchillian way of speaking. And to this, I would add the following fascinating fact. In 1932, Churchill published an essay called Moses, Leader of a People. There he described Moses' encounter with the burning bush in the wilderness in the following way. And listen to this, because this is amazing. Perhaps it was not a bush at all, but his own heart that was aflame with a fire never to be quenched while the earth supports human beings. God spoke to Moses from the burning bush. He said to him, in effect, writes Churchill, you cannot leave your fellow countrymen in bondage. Death or freedom is better in the wilderness than slavery. You must go back and bring them out. Let them live among this thorn scrub or die if they cannot live. But no more let them be chained in the house of bondage. Then, writes Churchill, God went a good deal further. He said from the burning bush, now surely inside the frame of Moses, I will endow you with superhuman power. There is nothing that man cannot do if he wills it with enough resolution. Man, writes Churchill, is the epitome of the universe. All moves and exists as a result of his, meaning man's, invincible will, which is my will, meaning God's will. It is an astonishing and fascinating interpretation. Moses' story for Churchill is one of human will overcoming all odds, and it is impossible not to get the impression that in describing Moses in the wilderness, Churchill is writing about himself, who was then in the political wilderness. But this is not Moses' story. I love different versions of the Moses story. I have embraced and read and watched many diverse understandings and interpretations of the Moses story. From the Ten Commandments in the 1950s, otherwise known as the greatest movie ever made, to Ridley Scott's Exodus, Gods and Kings, otherwise known as the worst movie ever made. Okay? I have seen it all, but this is not Moses' story. Moses' story is not one of human will being able to accomplish everything. Rightly understood, it is the opposite. Moses' story is not one of a God who tells him, better death in the desert than slavery in Egypt. It is the story of a God who tells him, Zelecha ot ki anochi shlachticha, this is the sign that I have sent you. When you take Israel out of bondage, you will serve me on this mountain. Thus, when two other Israelites prophesy in the Torah reading of this week, and Moses' disciple Joshua sees this as an assault on Moses' own prophetic leadership, his master criticizes him sharply, saying, Moses said to him, art thou jealous for my sake? Would that all the Lord's people were prophets, that the Lord would put his spirit upon them. This is the humility for which he is known. Moses, the lesson of Moses' life is not that man is the epitome of the universe, but that God is. And an essential aspect of Mosaic humility was his seeing himself as a vessel in God's hands. Now, why is this so important? If the great-souled nature of Churchill was so central to his success, why does Judaism insist on humility in its leaders? The answer can perhaps be found in the first moment after the election, where Lincoln explicitly references humility in his remarks to the New Jersey State House, speaking about his reading as a child of the American Revolution. And Lincoln says the following, I recollect thinking then, boy even though I was, that there must have been something more than common that those men struggled for, that something even more than national independence, that something that held out a great promise to all the people of all the world to all time to come. I am exceedingly anxious that the Union, the Constitution, and the liberties of the people shall be perpetuated in accordance with the original idea for which that struggle was made, and I shall be most happy indeed if I shall be an humble instrument in the hands of the Almighty, and of this his almost chosen people, for perpetuating the object of that great struggle. America, Lincoln is arguing here, is an almost chosen people. And that is why its leader must be a humble instrument in the hands of the Almighty. Lincoln seems to suggest that the America story is parallel to and an imitation of Israel's. The story of the birth of America, of the American founding, is about more than national independence. It is about an original idea, one which holds out a great promise for all the world. This imitation of Israel for Lincoln is the heart of American exceptionalism. America is not Israel's replacement, but it is its imitator, learning the lessons of Israel's biblical story, knowing that, like Israel, it will always be under God's judgment and that its well-being depends on its loyalty to the ideas for which it was actually founded. The leader of America, like the leader of Israel, Lincoln is telling us, must reflect humility, because only then can he point the people to something higher than the state itself, something higher than national independence itself, and inculcate thereby in the citizens he serves an awe at the chosenness or almost chosenness that is achieved by the nation in God's providential plan. This aspect of American exceptionalism achieves its finest moments in Lincoln's second inaugural, where all of his previous reflections on the inscrutability of God's will is finally and fully put into words. It is the greatest speech in American history because of its humility. Reading Lincoln's inaugural through Jewish and biblical eyes, one is astounded how on the brink of victory, Lincoln engages not in triumphalism, but rather facing 500,000 dead. He makes not an idol out of the nation state, but does not deny American exceptionalism. He calls the country to repentance, sees in the war punishment for the sin of slavery, and proclaims that the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. As Paul Johnson has pointed out, it is impossible to imagine Lincoln's European contemporaries, Napoleon III, Bismarck, Gambetta, Garibaldi, Thiers, Cavour, Marx, or Disraeli, thinking in these terms. And that is because Lincoln is drawing on the Bible and its way of thinking about politics in communicating to his citizens that they are called as Americans to pursue something higher than the state itself. As Ray Jonathan Sacks has put it, the founders of America turned to the Hebrew Bible, and successive presidents have done likewise, because Israel, ancient and modern, and the United States are the two supreme examples of societies constructed in conscious pursuit of an idea. When Lincoln breathed his last in the middle of Passover 1865, it was the Jews who instinctively compared Lincoln the Emancipator to Moses. But Christians as well could not help but make the comparison. Perhaps the most eloquent eulogy of all was delivered by Reverend Charles Lowe, who was from Massachusetts, but who spoke of all places courageously, forthrightly, in South Carolina. And he highlighted there the almost chosenness of America and Lincoln's capacity for combining both majesty and humility. Lowe exclaimed, "He, Lincoln, stands before us and will so stand in history as the Moses of this Israel of ours, the medium of the willing instrument of God. He has led us through the wanderings of the wilderness for 4 long years. Meek, but like his great prototype, not with the meekness of imbecility," meaning, like Moses, not with the meekness of imbecility, "but of reliance on a power that was not his own, yearning like him for the deliverance of the people he was appointed to lead, standing firm in his purpose when they, in moments of discouragement, sighed after the flesh pots they had left behind. The parallel became complete," he continued, "when at last, after the final act of the struggle was consummated, he was called to die. It was like Moses upon Mount Nebo, where he was permitted to see, but not himself to enter, the promised land." 100 years later, in 1965, Winston Churchill passed away. Leo Strauss, who has cast notes, was a great student of Aristotle's writings, delivered an impromptu eulogy for Churchill in his class. It was eloquent, yet very different in substance from that of Charles Lowe. Strauss concluded as follows: "We have no higher duty and no more pressing duty than to remind ourselves and our students of political greatness, human greatness of the peaks of human excellence. For we are supposed to train ourselves and others in seeing things as they are. And this means, above all, in seeing their greatness and their misery, their excellence and their vileness, their nobility and their triumphs, and therefore never to mistake mediocrity, however brilliant, for true greatness." Strauss is right. But Judaism has its own unique notion of what political excellence truly is, and there are so few examples in the history of the West where that form of excellence is achieved, embodied, reified. Today, America faces the question of nationalism again, of how we can celebrate America as a nation state while remembering still the higher calling to which the almost chosen people is summoned. Meanwhile, in Israel, Jews face a question not faced for 2 millennia. How can a Jewish polity produce leaders, statesmen, that celebrate Israeli independence and even its power, while still reflecting awe at the Jewish story, the mission of the actual chosen people, which is rightly understood even higher than the state itself. To answer these questions, we look surely to the Bible first and foremost. But to bridge the Bible to our own times, we need modern examples of excellence. And statesmen that embody the Jewish balance of majesty and humility are few and far between. It is with Lincoln's humility that we bring our series on the Civil War to a close. And it is with Lincoln's humility that, please God, a discussion of the biblical notion of statesmanship and leadership in the modern age can begin again. Thank you very much.